With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to a special episode of Radio Motherboard, which I say every week. This is Jason Kevler, the editor-in-chief of Motherboard. And this week, we've got a live episode from the Kickstarter offices in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, right next to my house. This week, we're talking to Brian Merchant, who is a former Motherboard senior editor and the author of The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. Brian has spent the last year looking into the iPhone, exploring its cultural relevance, traipsing all around the world, tracking down the inventors of the iPhone and the technologies within it. So he went to CERN to talk about the touchscreen technology. He talked to the inventor of the lithium ion battery. Brian and I went to mines in Chile and Bolivia, and he went to the Foxconn factory in China and obviously Cupertino. We're also doing this as part of Motherboard's What is the iPhone Week. So I am bringing on Luis Matsakis, who is our assistant editor, and Nicholas De Leon, who's an editor at Motherboard, to talk about their stories in which we explore how the iPhone has impacted our culture. This is a very fun episode, and let's get into it.
I want to start this off by pointing out that this is my dear friend Brian Merchant. He's wearing a very nice shirt, and on his author photo, he's wearing the same shirt.
I just didn't want there to be any confusion.
Yeah.
It's this guy.
I'm Jason Kebler. I'm the new editor-in-chief of Motherboard. Thank you all for coming here.
Well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. This is our second live podcast.
Such high demand.
I wanted to talk to Brian about the creation of The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone, which is your magnum opus, I believe.
To date, yeah.
To date, the highlight of your life. Brian didn't write about the iPhone at all at Vice, very little, and then he went off and wrote probably the best piece of Apple reporting I've ever seen. I've read this many times throughout the course of its creation.
Against your will sometimes, but yeah, I do appreciate it.
Yeah.
Jason, so what also should be noted is that Jason is a recurring character in this book. He shows up perhaps when you least expect him to, when we're about to like go into a tin mine, for example, or I think in Chile also.
Yeah, so I screenshotted like the 4 pages that I'm on, and it's all very bad things happening to us. So I went to Chile and Bolivia with Brian to report out part of the book. Do you want to tell them what the book is about first?
Maybe? Okay, yeah, we've gotten ahead of ourselves a little bit. So the idea is to sort of take a wide lens approach to looking at the iPhone, given that it just does have so much weight and cultural gravity in our lives now, and just kind of to tear it apart piece by piece and sort of tell the stories of its components, of its material origins, of the labor that makes it possible, sort of in tandem with the story of how it was actually invented within Apple. Because as you might know, if you follow any of Jason's reporting or Motherboard stuff, we all know that Apple goes to great lengths to seal this thing up, literally and figuratively, to make it really difficult to get inside. You need a custom screwdriver to repair the thing, and most of us stop kind of thinking about it. It's just becoming more and more like magic. So I thought it would be worthy just to kind of dive in and just, you know, really start at the beginning of where the device comes from and try to tell that story.
Yeah, so Motherboard is a website that very rarely writes about gadgets, I think. But so it might be weird that we're having like a whole event about a gadget.
Yeah.
But I think that the way you approached it, which is how I'd expect from you, is these are the people who made the iPhone. These are the lives affected by it. So we talked to miners, or he talked to miners. I talked to some miners too. Talked to factory workers, talked to the people who invented the lithium ion battery and the touchscreen and stuff like that. So yeah. You went all over the world tracing down the cultural roots of this thing and the technological underpinnings of the stuff inside of it. Where did you go?
If the idea was to sort of start at the basest element and then follow its sort of construction and ultimate completion into a device, I made an effort to try to make a stop that would exemplify each of those items along the way. So the trip that Jason came with me on and was a translator and fixer and all of our stuff getting stolen in Chile. We went to the mines to in Bolivia to see where the tin comes from, which Apple publishes its supplier list, so we know, for instance, that it gets some of its tin from this mine. So we told that piece of the story. And then I went to China, to Shanghai and Shenzhen, to meet factory workers, to meet the people who spend 12 hours a day on their feet assembling these things in places that are publicized from time to time due to their poor working conditions. And then I moved on. I tried to look at places that had contributed to the technological evolution of some of the core technologies like multi-touch. I went to CERN, where one of the first multi-touch panels was invented, but kind of vanished into the history of technology because CERN doesn't patent its stuff. And according at least to its inventor, who believes that the same technology, the fingerprints of it anyways, are in the iPhone, he believes he's just been kind of written out of history. So I got his take, and then, slowly you put all these pieces together, and then you go to Cupertino to try to meet as many of the iPhone inventors, people who were there at Apple, who sort of worked behind the scenes for a long time to get a lot of these ideas on the table that would coalesce into the iPhone.
Right, before so this came out 10 years ago, or it was announced 10 years ago this week,
yeah.
And Steve Jobs stood on stage and said, this is the one device, here is my gift to you, humanity. And we always think of like Steve Jobs as the inventor of the iPhone. And I feel like a big running thread through the book is that Steve Jobs did not invent the iPhone.
Yeah. And it's, rarely headline news that somebody did not invent something. But in this case, I think it's really worth peeling apart that particular mythology because it factors so heavily into how Silicon Valley, especially, which is believed to be this engine of innovation. And it is, it does a lot of great stuff, but we have this founder myth, this startup hero that can be really problematic and at best very one-dimensional. And especially with Apple and its recent string of successful products, that really is sort of the line. If you're not paying attention, if you just kind of absorb it through osmosis, then it's just, it's like, oh yeah, Steve Jobs, he invented all this stuff and the world's a better place now. Which is, it doesn't do anyone any favors to have that sort of simplistic view of how these things happen. Most certainly not all the people involved in those steps that we just kind of mentioned. That was important to me to kind of try to get at the nuances and sort of get at the hidden stories.
Yeah, I'm not like extremely interested normally in like the Kremlinology of Apple, but right. You talk to like a lot of people at Apple who worked on the iPhone, and I was very surprised by how aggrieved they feel. Like, they're not terribly happy with the fact that no one knows who they are.
Yeah.
So I guess, A, like, how did you start finding these people? And B, like, what did they feel like?
Step one on that process was to just look at the patents. There are some patents that are generally regarded to be some of the more influential iPhone patents. Steve Jobs' name is always first on them, but, you move on to number 2, 3, 4, and some of them have 29 names on them. So I just started, what do you do as a tech journalist? Working.
You write about what Apple tells you to write about.
Well, right. You hit LinkedIn and you start messaging people. Yeah, I just started reaching out to everybody that I could. And I think word kind of got out that there was this guy doing this history of the iPhone, and some of them lightened up and some of them. And by the end, I was talking to people who were still working in Apple, who were meeting me in dive bars and who are talking to me over secure communications, and were just to get their story out there. Because it really is remarkable. I know Apple's secrecy, blah, 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 is kind of a cliche at this point, but it is really true. These guys, some of them I think are like the most influential user interface and software designers of the last 20 years, and literally nobody knows who they were before this, outside headhunters in the industry and that kind of thing.
Did a lot of them look at it as like, this is my chance to get my name out there?
I don't think anyone would say it so explicitly, but you got the sense that they wanted history corrected a little bit. I mean, Apple was so secretive at the time that even while they were working on this project, just internally, there are no internal photos of the process or of them just in the room hanging out. It was never like, hey, these are my colleagues, like, barbecue. It was never like that. It was all just, it was work, 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 go home for 20 minutes, went back to work, 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 work. I had these crazy stories of people telling me that this guy, Richard Williamson, who was one of the creators of Safari and then one of the key engineers who squeezed it into the iPhone, he had his first kid during the iPhone development, went to the hospital, saw the kid, went back to work. Like, literally. It was, like, that sort of all-encompassing. There's a huge fight that broke out. One of the most famous sort of episodes of iPhone lore was one of the engineers was trying to go home on Saturday afternoon, but there was going to be a meeting for the team, and the product manager blew up at him and said, we all have kids, blah, you know, we all want to go home. And he went to leave anyways, and she slammed the door so hard that the doorknob broke and she locked herself in the office. And the executive had to come with an aluminum bat and bash it off. It was just like crazy tension, crazy secrecy. People had no outlets. So I think, yeah, there's like a real effort for people to want to relay the work that they did in creating this thing at this point. 10 years later, it's like, why can't we share this story now? You know,
why the iPhone? Like, we're doing a whole series of stories about the iPhone, and I have my reasons for thinking that it's like an important device in our culture.
But yeah.
You call it the one device. Steve Jobs called it the one device. Like, there's a line in your book about how clothes, glasses, iPhone. Like, that's right. Pretty much what people carry on them at all times.
Yeah, that was a great quote from this mobile technology historian who was like, he has surveyed these patterns for hundreds of years, and it's like, he says it's vanishingly rare that humans pick a new object to carry with them at all times. And it's true. It was like clothes, which is like, that's like a Paleolithic thing. And it's like glasses. And like, what else? I mean, what else do we, a wallet maybe, but they're accessories, and then it's our phone. So it must have some sort of import that goes above and beyond most other objects. And not only that, but it's got this impressive list of most, you know, it's the most ubiquitous, most popular model of mobile computing ever made. You know, between iPhone and the Android that emulates it, this is how humanity uses computers 90% of the time. Like, this is how we interact with computing devices. And so I think trying to understand why that is and how that came about is a really worthwhile thing. Again, it's the most profitable product ever made by some counts. It edged out Marlboro cigarettes, and that's like a product that literally addicts you and compels you to buy more.
So does the phone.
So does the phone, right, yeah. right.
Should we talk about our trip real quick? Real quick, it was a good trip.
It was a great trip. You know, yeah. We had some laughs. We stumbled into a terrible...
Brian had me organize a trip to Chile and Bolivia, which I had been to before. And we were going to check out the lithium mines in Chile and the tin mines in Bolivia.
Yeah, lithium, of course, many of you, I'm sure, know that it's the kind of the source of the most popular kind of battery now is a lithium-ion battery, and it powers not just phones and devices, but also electric car batteries. And most of it right now comes from these really kind of strange sort of methods of mining where they just kind of have these vast pools where they sort of pump the lithium, which sits in like kind of an underground shallow aquifer, and they pump it up and evaporate it, and they pump it again. So we visited these giant sort of alien plants.
Where they look like a Dali painting.
They
like
really do.
The colors are crazy as it starts evaporating.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And you go at sunset, and they kind of like reflect. The mountains are salmon color. It's very alien. It's the same region that is the driest place on Earth apart from the poles, and it's where NASA tests like its Mars rovers because it's so Mars-like there that it's good for that. So yeah, so we went there.
That's where we started, and everything went fine. It was beautiful.
Right.
And then I had to start fixing things. So we went to the bus station to take a bus somewhere, and I immediately got both of our laptops stolen and Brian's phone that he had smuggled out of Shenzhen.
Yeah.
Which was disappointing.
It was disappointing, but then it also kind of like proved kind of an interesting point about that, because then all we had was our phones, and like back to that point, to that quote, it became like a mantra. You kept saying, I think, what was your quote? You kept saying like, you're
phone,
like,
oh, passport,
phone, passport, wallet. Check, that's all we have or need.
Like, well, that's all we had, because the next morning we were going to get on another bus and Brian got the rest of our stuff stolen. So between dinner and breakfast, we had been robbed twice.
In like 24-hour period.
No, it was like 10 hours.
Okay,
it
10
was like
hours.
Very quick.
We like lost a, we like lost half of our stuff. Like we so Jason had just like his camel, but we just sound like bumbling buffoons.
Which we weren't. It was
No, it was. So like we were walking to the bus station and Jason's like camel bag broke and he's like, oh shit. And he like took out his laptop and put it in my backpack. And I'm like, okay, great. And then I was like, all right, I'll go get some food, you know, watch the stuff. I'll be right back. And I came back and I was like, where's the backpack? And Jason's like, shit. And we ran screaming into this. Somebody was like, yeah, somebody just sat down, put it on, like an old man did misdirection.
Yeah, it was socially engineered.
Yeah, it was socially engineered.
Anyways, the rest of the trip was great.
And we did it with our phone. Like, that's the thing. Like, I recorded all the interviews with my phone. I took all the photos with my phone. I wrote, like, parts of chapters on the phone. And it was, like, kind of just this, like, unfortunately fortuitous way to just like demonstrate some of the things that were happening in the book anyway.
Yeah, I think the other really interesting story from your travels is how you snuck into Foxconn. So do you want to tell us that? Because very few reporters have ever been inside Foxconn and you went.
Yeah, we got really lucky. I was there with a fixer from a journalist from Shanghai, and we'd spent all day trying to get in through, you know, above board channels, just talking to workers, and the workers, a lot of them were eager to talk, and they gave great interviews, and then they'd talk to their managers and said, hey, our manager can get you, and he still works there. And we tried a couple of those, and we tried hanging out at the entrance and just asking very nicely, and that didn't work. So by like the time like early afternoon rolled around, I had to piss. I had to go to the bathroom so bad, and we were just like, you know what, it's like worth a shot. So we had walked around, and we went to a different entrance with a much more bored-looking guard. And we were just like, just let us in to use the bathroom, man. Just, we'll be right back. We'll just come right back. My fixer was just like, he has to go. Look at him. He has to go. And the guy was just, eventually, he's just like, I've had enough. And he's just like, okay, come right back. And then we just bolted. And we didn't look back. And we spent an hour and a half inside this factory that is one of the most secretive factories going, most famously secretive. As soon as we got inside, I was immediately worried about, you know, what might happen if we get caught, especially for my fixer, who's a Chinese national. But, I mean, beyond that, it was just this, like, incredible window into this city-sized factory. At its height, there were 500,000 people working and living and existing in these factories. It's the size of a city. It's a city-state. Basically.
Yeah, I always feel weird when people say that Foxconn is a factory because it's a city. Like,
it's a
there's
city.
There's a 7-Eleven outside. Yeah. There's like there's a plazas and squares and
inside
stuff.
Inside the factory, in the dead middle, just like a city, it's gentrified in the middle. It gets less nice on the outside. There are, you know, and then we walked from one end to the other, and it took the whole hour to walk the whole thing. And it's rusty, and there's like chemical spills and like cones and just kind of a place where you clearly don't want to be on the outskirts and some of the clearly a little rougher bits of the manufacturing process there. And as you go inside, there's more technical jobs, and they clearly have a wide range of people doing a wide range of jobs and just sheer hordes of workers. 18 to 25 looked like to me and my translator, but yeah, it was just the sheer scale of this thing was really impressive.
The book came out last week. How has the response been? Has Apple come after you? Anything happen of note?
What nice question. Yeah.
Besides this podcast at Kickstarter. Thank you, Kickstarter, for having us, by the way.
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, no, I think it's been, Apple has denied one thing, you know, like, I don't think that the ties to child labor in Bolivia have been reported before. The fact that there's still a suicide epidemic going on at the factories in Shenzhen has not been reported before. The fact that one of its executives at one point in time argued for a hard keyboard had not been reported before. And that's the scandal, of course. That this marketing executive wanted BlackBerry-styled keys for the iPhone. So that's what everybody kind of fixated on in this like original round of explosion. But that's just a testament to how crazy, you know, people feel how like how much power this thing has and how what a fan base it 10 years later it still has.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell on that, but like what happened? This like Verge inspired fallout.
Yeah, so I published the excerpt and it contained this part, and the quote was given to me by Tony Fadell, who was one of the executives in charge of the iPod at the time. He was the executive in charge of the iPod, so he was a natural sort of successor to do some iPhone stuff. And he told me the story on the record. I had it, have it recorded, and it was very elaborate, and it feels very true. It feels like a very reasonable thing for an executive to be arguing for a BlackBerry keyboard. But Phil Schiller, the marketing executive, came out and denied it on Twitter, which sort of set off this backlash. And then Tony Fadell, for whatever reason, you know, I could speculate why, but, you know, it's probably clear. He backtracked on his comments, maybe not remembering that I had a record of it or not. But yes.
Got the tapes.
Got the tapes.
Got the tapes.
There are tapes.
All right.
There are tapes.
I'm bored. I want to bring up Luis Matsakis, who is a new assistant editor for Motherboard, and Nicholas De Leon, who's an editor at Motherboard, because to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the iPhone, we are doing something called iPhone Week. Very elaborate name.
What is the iPhone, right?
What is the iPhone, yeah. So this week, Motherboard's running 25 or so stories, depending on how many I edit today, about the iPhone and how it affects our lives. So Nicholas was actually a tech reporter when the iPhone launched.
Yeah.
I don't even remember the iPhone coming out, so.
Yeah, no,
it was very impressive to me.
Yeah, I've had the rare privilege to have been in this business long enough to remember the iPhone launch. I remember not just the launch, I remember the pre-iPhone hype cycle. I remember seeing the renderings on like Mac Rumors and Apple Insider where they had like, they would basically just take like an iPod and put like a rotary dial on it and be like, it's the iPhone, right? So I remember all of that. And I remember I was sitting in Las Vegas when it was announced. I think it was January 6, 2007. I was covering CES, which is the big tech show, sitting in the press room, and like 600 miles away, Steve Jobs is in San Francisco and he announces the iPhone. Now I'm sitting in this press room with a bunch of other like tech reporters, and Steve Jobs just completely invalidated CES for the rest of the week because he's 600 miles away. He announced the future, and we're over here in Las Vegas looking at like printers and like TVs and stuff. So it was kind of it was kind of ridiculous. But yeah, my memories from the early days. It's funny how like now when Apple when Apple doesn't do anything, it's like a story. It's like, oh, why haven't they looked into AR? Like Apple was not that like important back then. Like even during the iPod, when like everyone had an iPod, it was just not that pervasive and like all consuming, this Apple like controlling our lives. And it wasn't until several years into the iPhone, because the iPhone was, you know, wasn't the first smartphone, and it took a couple generations for it to really kind of like blow up. I would say with like the iPhone,
I may be wrong here, but I don't remember the first iPhone being very popular. It was like the store that...
Well, no, the first iPhone was like priced ridiculously expensive, and then they cut the price like 6 months later. Right.
That was a huge scandal.
Yeah, yeah. Like, all the early adopters were like, this is outrageous. And I remember all this stuff like it was yesterday. The Apple blogosphere was like way smaller and like way more intimate. Now there's a million publications. But back then it was like way more intimate and way more interesting in a way.
Were you working for TechCrunch then?
Or? Yeah, yeah. I was at TechCrunch. Yeah. I was here in New York. I remember seeing all the Fifth Avenue store, the lines. I remember just like honestly like hating having to cover like a line at a store. I was like, are you kidding me? Like I went to college to talk to people standing in line to buy a phone. Come on. But that
lines aren't that bad anymore, really.
No, there are no lines. That was, remember iPhone lines? We don't have that anymore. That was like a cultural, like I remember seeing CNN trucks and CNBC trucks and people like, this was a thing. This was like the realization of like the personal computer. It's like, okay, it's a computer in every desk. It's like, no, now it's in your pocket. And that's a big deal. It's the internet in your pocket. So it was like, yeah, it was definitely interesting the early days, and definitely interesting to see the evolution where now it's like, now no one even cares. Like the iPhone WWDC, who cares? The iPhone event, no, it's like it just happens, and you pre-order it when it goes on sale. But it's
part
not
of our culture.
Yeah,
now. It's like it's important still. Like people still cover it,
but it's not an event. It was like as the closest thing to like I don't watch football, but like the Super Bowl is a big deal. So I hear. But like it was a really big deal, and it was sort of cool because like as like professional nerd, effectively, it was neat to see like this smartphone, a capsule. Like, everyone's like, you see, this stuff is cool. All you people who like hated, like, you know, weren't into computers. It's like, well, actually, no, it is cool. And you're all using it. And now you're all playing Angry Birds. So like, who was right? So it was way smaller and way, I would say it was different in a sense, more interesting. But to see the evolution where now it's just taken for granted. And now we're coming to the other side where like there are people who are there who I'm sure were like seething, like, why aren't I giving interviews on CNBC? Why is it all Phil Schiller everywhere? Who cares? You know, it's like now there's stories out there. So now it's, now yeah, everything's right now.
I don't necessarily want to get like too into how Apple talks to the media because it might be boring, but Louise just came from Mashable and they talk to Apple quite often.
Yeah, we had a lot of relationships with Apple, and I don't know how much of the conversations I had with them were off the record, but I can tell you for a fact that they have a house in Tribeca that they rent out and let reporters come to. And I got there and someone on an iPad already knew who I was and I'd never met them before. And that was my first experience as like a young tech reporter being like, wow, this is kind of a cult. And like, I didn't really understand the power that they could wield. And it was interesting.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You go into these meetings and you're in this beautiful house in Tribeca and they're trying to woo you. And every word that comes out of everyone's mouth is completely scripted. And it's effortlessly so. And then you ask a question they weren't expecting and they don't have an answer for you. And then that person gets like pushed into like the back of the room and then someone else is talking to you suddenly. And you start to realize like what a charade it is. And it's amazing. There are a lot of reporters who were there who, you know, diligently taking notes. And the next day, you know, I saw those stories and it's really amazing what an apparatus they've kind of created, which is why I think it's really important that books like Brian's exist, because they are like a counter narrative to that. And I really wanted to ask you, I think I grew up a little bit later than Nicholas. And by the time I kind of got an iPhone, there started to become a conversation about what happens after you get another iPhone. And when I was young, I never really thought about the fact that I always wanted the next phone. It was such a part of my childhood that, you know, or my teenage years, that it never really, I was like, I just don't want this one anymore. Like, I want the newest one. And then I took a trip to West Africa last year, which I know you also went to the same region. And I'd love to hear about your experience in Nairobi and what happens after the hype cycle, like Nicholas talked about, for the next phone. What happens to that phone you get rid of?
Yeah, I went there for two reasons, and one was to like look at the burgeoning sort of app scene there, and to try to follow some e-waste streams, which I think is what you're asking about. And yeah, I mean, these phones wind up in dumps. You know, a lot of people just, you know, the battery dies and they're done with them, and they do just go on to the next. Maybe they spend like a few months in a drawer somewhere, and then they get dumped out.
Can we do a quick show of hands? Like, how many people have an old phone
in a drawer right now?
In a drawer or a closet?
Wow.
Yeah, everyone. Wow. And I mean, I have one too, and I write about how bad this is all the time.
Yeah.
I have just one.
Yeah.
Yeah. But these phones, they take a lot of earth to mine and a lot of labor, and our phones and our computers are still good for a long time after we get rid of them, even if they're broken, even if they're in like a million pieces. For this week, I talked to a bunch of iPhone repair people about the most fucked up phone that they'd seen. One fell 400 feet off of a wind turbine and cracked into like 1,000 pieces. Another guy shot his with a gun.
For some reason.
Yeah, because apparently someone at the Apple store told him the screen is practically bulletproof, and so he shot it with a gun.
Yeah, Jason sent that photo to me like on with no context over Slack, and I was like, what?
And these phones got fixed, and they're still working today, presumably.
Right.
Two people told me that teens broke their phone by strapping their iPhone to a ceiling fan because they were playing Pokemon Go. So they wanted to get their steps up.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So people do really dumb stuff with their phones. And you can fix these things and you can resell them, and that's the best thing that you can do with a phone.
Yeah.
Because they have life for quite some time.
And they're still pretty valuable.
That's what I'm saying. Like, these retain their value for a long time. I know a guy who still sells, like, the old MacBooks from, like, 2009.
Yeah.
That's all he does. He, like, gets them from electronics recyclers and sells them.
Yeah.
And he makes thousands of dollars.
And it's given rise to, like, sort of this host of, like, really super skilled repairmen. When they're at sort of this dump in Kenya, like on the side, they would fish the phones out. They'd end up in these fairly sophisticated waste streams that kind of end up in a few hot spots around the world. But then they can take something with a mangled screen, grab a new one, and watching these guys work, they're pros.
Yeah, you know? I know a guy who used to repair phones on the subway.
Yeah.
Like on the L.
Yeah.
Of course it was the L.
Yeah, it was the L.
One of the guys in Shenzhen, I visit this black market in Shenzhen, it's gone. It was insane. It was like four stories high, filled with nothing but iPhone parts, component bits. And I showed you some of the photos of this, and it's really wild. It's just like an entire stall filled with just the little Apple logo that gets fastened on the back of the phone. So you go there and you get that. You get like an entire stall full of just the casing.
So does someone go and like, are they like, okay, today I'm going to build my phone?
That's what I did. I asked this guy, I was like, how much would it cost for you to start from scratch and just build me a phone? And he said like $50, the equivalent of $50. And I watched him go from stall to stall. We cheated a little bit because he grabbed a motherboard that had a bunch of the components, but camera here, you know, the lithium ion battery here, the, you know, some of the digitizers were bust. So he got some new ones from a little stall that sold those. And this is just an entire hub, like the size of a small indoor mall in China. And all of those pieces had been extracted, moved around, refined, cleaned up. And I was there with a waste expert, and he was like, you know, there's a good chance if you buy your phone on eBay, even if it says it's coming from Texas, there's a good chance it's coming from right here.
And why not? I mean, if it still works, it's fine.
Right. I love that. It's like the question is, like, what makes a phone? If you buy it in the Apple store, is it an iPhone? Or these exact sort of functioning parts that work exactly the same, run the same software? Although I also saw an iPhone that ran Android software too, which is kind of trippy.
I have not seen that before. Louise, I want to talk to you real quick about the story you've been reporting, because I think it's important. You're talking about the people who prove apps for the App Store, which, if we agree that the iPhone is such an important piece of technology, the fact that Apple decides what can and cannot be on there is quite concerning. So like in the past, Apple has not allowed an app that tracks U.S. drone strikes in the Middle East to be on the App Store. A couple weeks ago, we reported a story saying that Pepe is banned from the App Store, the frog.
Meme
frogs on the App Store. So I guess, like, what have you learned, and why is this important?
So I think that, I was going to say we've had a long conversation tonight about the hardware, and I think it's also important to talk about the software. And as Brian wrote in his book, Steve Jobs is originally against the idea of building an app store. He was like, this is Apple's thing. We don't want there to be third-party developers. It's going to cause it to crash. Like, I don't want that. And then about half a year after the iPhone first came out, they finally launched the app store, which is today almost a $30 billion business. You know, we've seen a crazy amount of developers become rich off of what is now known as the app economy. And so I heard Pepe and the Drone Strike app, those were kind of the examples I was really familiar with. But in my reporting, I've discovered that Apple basically has one of the longest track records of censorship of any tech company. The amount of censorship that they've done in the App Store is like absurd. And I think the most interesting examples are the contradictions, right? Like, for a while, they were banning bikini apps. Like, if you wanted to, you know, get a wallpaper with, like, women wearing bikinis, that was not allowed. But then several months later, they not only allowed, but featured the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition app. It was a special app for the Swimsuit Edition because there was a business relationship there. And I think the most interesting examples are where Apple makes economic decisions to favor their own business. And you realize, like, no, this isn't just, like, this nice app store they've made for you to put stuff on your iPhone. They're making these strategic decisions that are completely shielded from developers who've, in some cases, spent their entire lives making these apps that are then not allowed to Apple's 700 million iPhone users.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. There's like this famous anecdote in a New York Times profile of Travis Kalanick by friend of Motherboard Mike Isaac. And Tim Cook like called Travis Kalanick into his office, the CEO of Uber, and Uber was doing some shady stuff, if you could imagine. And yeah.
What?
And Tim Cook was basically like, look, if you don't cut this out, we're taking Uber out of the App Store. And like, can you imagine if Apple deleted Uber, like, right, across every iPhone? Like, people talk about what it would take to kill Uber. Like, that would kill Uber instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like such a great story, Elise. The other thing that I think is interesting to add to that is one of those famous, you know, once in a while, Steve Jobs would just, like, respond to
people who emailed. Yeah,
there's that email where, was it a Gizmodo writer who had emailed him about kind of complaining about...
Where's the porn?
Where he didn't let porn on it.
Yeah.
And they had this, and it was pretty revealing because he's like, there's just no porn on my machines, basically. Like,
he was
no
like, if you want porn, get an Android.
Yeah.
That's literally what he said.
So, and that is just reflective of a lot of things with the iPhone, is it just, it's playing by Steve Jobs, or now like the echo of Steve Jobs' sort of moral compass, whatever, you know, that was. In this case, no porn. So there's just no porn on the iPhone.
Yeah. I think that's like a good place to start taking audience questions. if you've got any
questions. You want to talk about porn. And
yeah, I mean, you can get porn on the iPhone if you really try. I think. I wouldn't know. But yeah.
Open that browser.
Theoretically.
Yeah, in theory.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, I just wanted to ask a little bit about, I think one of the topics that came up earlier was really interesting, was the story of, and maybe I'm using the term incorrectly, but kind of a potential catharsis that could happen when some of the individuals you spoke with, who it really sounds like spent an incredible amount of their lives working on this in secret and without sort of documentation. I'm kind of curious if you've heard any feedback yet, and maybe it's a little too early, or you think you might hear feedback from them about what their experience is like having now had that story documented and getting publicized, and whether there's a, you know, whether there's something that happens to them where they're sensing their story being told, and whether that's, you know, providing something to them in some way.
I did hear through the grapevine, literally, that one of the people whose story I tell in the book, who I feature in the book, who does still work at Apple, I heard through the grapevine that after the excerpt was published, he got a standing ovation when he came in because nobody knew that he was involved in this. No, even in Apple, nobody knows who the people are who worked on the iPhone. That's how secret it was and remains to be. I mean, Apple has always touted itself as this company that always looks forward, but it's so true in some senses that, you know, people are sitting right next to people that have this immense well of experience that they have no idea about.
I'm curious, can you just explain, like, what some of the security measures they took to make sure that the people who were working on the iPhone didn't, like, leak anything or...
Okay, yeah, so there are two parts. If you were working on iPhone software, that was like the most, that was like the Manhattan Project, basically, at Apple. It was, you would be invited to work on, you know, either Scott Forstall or one of his deputies would come into your office and basically say, we have this great project. I can't tell you what it is. I can't tell you anything about it. Do you want to come work on it? You will give up your weekends, your holidays, your lives. You have to tell me now. And a lot of people did, and they had to sign NDAs. Sometimes they had to sign an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, before they signed the next NDA, saying that I won't talk about, you know, what's on this NDA should I not decide to sign it because it's so intense. And then after you've signed your NDAs and you've sort of agreed to sacrifice your social life, then you can go to this building that was in a sort of a sealed off wing at Apple's campus, the Infinite Loop 2, which was, it was an area right above the Industrial Design Studio, and they had badge readers. It was sealed off. Nothing really got in. Very little got out. It was a sealed off, very smelly place, because these people lived in there, basically, around the clock.
What was the most surprising thing that you learned about the iPhone or how it was made?
The fun thing about reporting this book was that every chapter it was like, whoa, yeah. It was like really legitimately satisfying to like learn all this new stuff. So picking just one is hard. I think like for me, like the most surprising thing was to learn about the legacy of multi-touch. Because multi-touch is something that Steve Jobs literally like threw up on the screen and it said like, Apple invented multi-touch and boy, have we patented it. And like literally nothing about that statement is true. So, like, learning the whole legacy of how multi-touch began in the 80s, and then how one person who had come to work at Apple, Wayne Westerman, sort of invented the technology that we see in the iPhone now in its most basic form because he had hand injuries and he couldn't finish his dissertation because it hurt too much. So he invented this technology called Fingerworks that he started a company called Fingerworks that would allow him to swipe. And I love that story as kind of like a hidden history of what ended up getting baked into this thing that's so ubiquitous now.
I am wondering, What is the future for the iPhone now that, like, you know so much about where it came from and how it was made and how it has become this, like, dominant cultural force?
Yeah.
Do you think that this device, this one device, will be the one device in 5 years, 10 years? Like, Where does the iPhone go from here, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, and I kind of have a boring answer to that question because I think that's exactly right. I think for a lot of reasons, the iPhone will probably look a lot like it does today in 10 years or, you know, whatever is the dominant sort of smartphone is. And there's a couple reasons that I cite when I think about that, and that's because 10 years ago, the iPhone launched in a form that where many of the sort of most basic fundaments are basically what they are today, right? It's a touch screen. The same kind of UI ingredients are the dominant part of the user interface. It's still app-based. I think like the things that have changed are like little flourishes like Force Touch, and we hear about, you know, Siri got added, and now we're hearing about augmented reality and things like this. But they're really like iterations kind of taking place on the side of the sandbox, like the core powerhouse of the phone. You know, yeah, it's gotten faster, bigger screen, whatever, but the core elements haven't really budged all that much. And I think that speculating is always like kind of a fool's errand, but you know, I could see it becoming kind of like this core central part of our lives, like the car did. The sedan isn't that much different than it was 50 years ago on like sort of a philosophical level. We're probably going to have an iPhone that looks a lot like the iPhone in 10 years.
It's interesting because Apple has done so much to lock you into continuing to buy the iPhone. Like, right. I think maybe part of Katie's question was, like, is there a competitor that could take over? And like, what comes after the iPhone?
Yeah.
But in terms of like competitors, obviously Android is bigger than iPhone is right now, and it has been for quite some time. But Apple has done a lot with iCloud and with iMessage, especially to lock people into it. It's just like,
right.
Once you're sort of indoctrinated to leave, there's like a high barrier to leaving,
right.
I feel.
Yeah, there's different ways, you know, like, is it like the device, the smartphone that's kind of modeled after the iPhone mold, which, you know, the Android is more or less inspired by that sort of mold. And will that change and be taken over? I don't know. Another thing to think about is the fact that Apple has so many resources. It's so valuable. It makes so much money off of every iPhone. Like the Android has more units sold and it runs on more phones, but they don't make nearly as much money off of their phones as the iPhone does. So Apple has this huge imperative to sort of perpetuate this. It almost has a reason not to innovate in that classic sense.
The Foxconn anecdote, you said you ran around there for an hour and a half. What happened at the end of that? Did you get kicked out forcibly? And what happened to your colleague who accompanied you?
We decided to stop pressing our luck and just leave. It kind of, it's hard to go unnoticed in certain areas there. So I think we just decided that we'd kind of canvassed from one side of the other. We'd seen the factory blocks. We'd tried to get into a few of them. We'd spoken to a few folks, and we'd seen the dorms, and we just kind of both figured that it was time to go. So we did just kind of like, as casually as we could, joined like the stream of, it was evening then, and of workers who were exiting to go get a bite or something, just kind of shuffled out with the masses. And she's fine. Like, she's nothing. She never got ID'd or, you know, we're still in touch, and I had her read the chapter to verify details and quotes and stuff, and she is doing fine.
Hi, yes, thank you. It's Evan Rogers, social media manager for competing technology website and gadget.com.
Wow.
I did have
friend of motherboard.
Former motherboard employee.
Yeah.
I did have one question, which was just that, was there anything that you saw on your travels that would make you think that in the future we could have these devices without slavery or without, you know, human rights violations or rare damage to the environment? Was there anything that you saw that would kind of give you that impression?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is that it really wouldn't take that much. It would take a handful of different forces. One, it would take Apple deciding to actively do more, that it was willing to cut down on its profit margins a little bit to do more thorough and more aggressive supply chain audits. It does some good things, and probably does more than a lot of companies, but it could do more. It's so valuable. It has this, you know, this massive pool of hundreds of billions of dollars of cash sitting in a bank in Ireland. It can take things a little bit further. And, you know, we can demand more from them too. We can vote more. The culture could shift just a little bit. So right now we're on this hyper upgradability cycle where everybody wants a new phone every year, and Apple has been instrumental in promoting that mentality. So if all this work that Jason does on repairability, the message underlying all that is that we could have a gadget and fix it and upgrade it. And that's why a lot of people were, you know, excited, even though it ultimately got mocked, about like Google's modular phone, like something that you can upgrade. There is a path there. It's just there are economic and cultural forces that just have to be confronted in order to get there.
So I wanted to ask about jailbreaking and sort of the unlocking community, which emerged as a, you know, way secondary app economy. And as far as I understand, really prompted Apple to create an official app store in the first place. And I guess I wanted to know if you, I don't know if you go into this in the book, sorry, I haven't read it yet. But what the sense is from the rank and file inside Apple, whether they view these people as just super fans that are pushing the product forward, or whether the engineers feel the same way as you kind of feel like Apple corporate does about, like, this is something that must be squashed.
Lorenzo, give the mic to Lorenzo.
Wait, but did Lorenzo plant this question?
Yeah. Lorenzo, come up here.
So, yeah, we have actually a story.
There's no seat here.
Yeah, this is Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai. He's the best security reporter on Earth, save for maybe Joseph Cox.
That's fake news.
He's another reporter from Motherboard.
It's true.
He and Brian just worked on a gigantic feature about the history of jailbreaking and what's going on. It will run, I think, 2 days from now.
Maybe. Depends on Jason at this point.
It's in my hands.
So to answer your question, I think it was a little bit of both. So parts of Apple, especially at the higher level, they didn't like the jailbreakers. And they didn't like the fact that they basically hacked the phone and exposed that it wasn't as secure as Steve Jobs and people like him like to say. But other parts were sort of admired, that group. And they hung out with them unofficially. And as you said, like, they did take a lot of the stuff and the innovations that the jailbreakers pushed and incorporated them into the iPhone. So, for example, Brian has it in the book. He does talk about the fact that the App Store was basically, like, invented by the jailbreakers. And then Apple was like, oh, this is a good idea. Maybe we should do it. So, yeah, it's a little bit of both. It's like, you know, they didn't like the fact that they were, you know, going against the ivory tower, but they also liked what they were doing. So they incorporated it.
Yeah. Also, it's funny to note. Yeah. I actually just spoke with Jay Freeman, who was one of the key guys in building Cydia, which was the sort of the alternate app store formulation. And he was, you know, they all these jailbreaker guys would go to WWDC. They'd go to the developer conferences where Apple would put on their events for their legit developers. So they knew the community really well. And especially in the rank and file, there was some interfacing and they knew each other a little bit. But the other interesting thing to note is that it didn't stop when they just built the App Store. So, you know, it would go on for years that Apple would take features that would show up in Cydia and show up on jailbroken phones and go, oh, like the notification system, that's a cool idea. Like, let's do that. So a lot of them have direct sort of lineage from things people did with jailbreaking that were then ported over. I love that chapter because it's a great example of people. Like, I equate it in the book almost to like a public kind of protest, all of the different sort of groundswell against not having an open app store. So you had like developers just wanting it. You had like people breaking into the phone, kind of doing more subversive tactics to show, like to demonstrate what could be done with this power. And they were making mostly benign apps and having fun with it. And people were like, that's really cool. So yeah, it really did kind of inspire what would be the key foundation of kind of.
I would just add really quickly that sort of spirit of jailbreaking, that kind of tied into like, which was very big in the early and mid 2000s, like the anti-DRM kind of movement where it's like, no, I own this hardware, I should be able to do with it with what I want to do with it. And so the idea that like Apple says, here's this phone, but you can't put anything on it, that like lit the fire under those same guys who are like, well, actually, we're going to break into it and put install whatever software we want on it. So that's sort of like, you know, take this attitude was kind of really pervasive in a lot of like the open source and kind of like anti-DRM communities back then.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the story that Lorenzo and Brian are working on is kind of like, why don't people jailbreak their iPhones anymore? And one of the big reasons is because Apple just took all of their ideas and put it into the iPhone, so there's no reason to do it anymore. There still are some people who do it, but it is kind of a shame that now the walled garden is sort of like firmly in place. But now you have a lot of people jailbreaking other devices. Like you have a lot of farmers jailbreaking their tractors and stuff like that to repair them. So there are always wars to be fought, I suppose.
Yeah, also just to follow up, a lot of the people that were early jailbreakers ended up working for Apple. And not a lot, but like quite a few.
Some of them, yeah.
Like Nicolas Allegra was from New York, better known as Comics. He worked for Apple for like 6 months. Jonathan Zizjarski, who was like an early jailbreaker, is working at Apple right now. So it was. This tells you again, like, you know, what Apple did was just take them and their ideas and incorporate them.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for coming. Thank you so much, Kickstarter, for having us.
Thanks everyone for listening. I'm Jason Kebler. I was with Brian Merchant, the author of The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. It's available on Amazon and at your local bookstore. It's really good. I've read it multiple times. Brian is also our Terraform editor, which is our science fiction section. Thank you so much to Kickstarter and to Luis Matsakis and Nicholas De Leon, who are editors here at Motherboard and helped with our iPhone Week, which is available at motherboard.vice.com. Anything tagged with the tag What is the iPhone is part of that week. Our editor is Tim Barnes. Thank you, Tim, and we'll be back next week.